Welcome to another episode of the Sanskrit Studies podcast. My name is Antonia Ruppel, and my guest today is Andrew Ollett. Andrew, if you and I met on a plane or on a train, and I asked you, what do you do? What would your answer to me be?
Probably I would try to end the conversation as quickly as possible because I don't like talking to people on trains or planes, but I would say that I study Sanskrit.
In which case I, this is not me, but me, train interlocutor me, would say Sanskrit, what's that? And that's probably the reason why you don't want to talk to people on trains or planes.
Yes. let's see where to begin. Sanskrit is the entrance, the gateway to knowledge for pre-modern South Asia. So if you want to know anything about the languages, the cultures, the literature, the philosophy of South Asia, not just India as we think of it today, but everywhere from Central Asia to Southeast Asia to Indonesia, then you should probably learn Sanskrit. And that's because it was used to compose works of literature and systematic thought, and was used as the basis for a lot of vernacular languages for approximately 2,000 years.
How did you get interested in that?
It's a pretty regular story, I guess, for people of a certain generation. I came to college, Columbia University, actually trying to study neuroscience, and then I became disenchanted with neuroscience, and I decided to do something that was more intellectually stimulating for me, which was studying Greek and Latin, mostly Greek, in fact. So I took a intensive Greek course with Eleanor Dickey, in fact, who's now at the University of Reading, and my instructor, Eleanor Dickey, was a historical linguist and would very often bring in examples from Sanskrit to try to explain certain features of the Greek grammatical system. So in talking about the me verbs, she would mention that Sanskrit also has these verbs in me. And I became interested in Sanskrit for that reason and decided after my first year of Greek that I would just check out a bunch of Sanskrit books from the library and see how much I could learn. And then I joined the Sanskrit class in the following year. That was taught by Gary Tubb. We were reading the Ramayana. And then from that point on, it was easily the most interesting thing that I was doing. And I became increasingly interested in the language and the literature that was composed in Sanskrit. And because I get bored of things very quickly, I was heartened by Gary Tubb's comment that it's impossible to get bored in the field of Sanskrit because there's always more to read, there's always more to do. And that is probably the main reason why I ended up doing Sanskrit professionally rather than doing something else. When I was going to graduate school, I still had the idea that I might do Greek and Latin. So I hedged my bets and I did a degree in comparative philology, so comparing was basically Indo-European philology with Greek and Indo-Iranian. But from that, I moved squarely into Sanskrit and came back to Columbia to do my PhD with Sheldon Pollack.
And where did you do your degree in comparative or in Indo-European philology?
That was at the University of Oxford.
Right. And so you've got experience with classics, with comparative philology, with Indology. If you were to talk to someone interested in studying any of these subjects, what would your main advice be?
Well, I mean, let me put it this way. With, you know, for some reason, there's a lot of, there used to be, I think this is changing now, but there used to be a lot of energy and intellectual effort directed at understanding languages that were never written and might never have existed. that's great, of course. I still believe that historical linguistics is the key to understanding a lot of what we know about the languages that have actually existed. I would say that if you think about the languages of India, right, there are hundreds, dozens to hundreds, depending on how you count them. Many of these have literary traditions going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And so for the same language family or group of related languages, we have evidence, literary and documentary inscriptional evidence that goes back 2,000 years. And very few people who are interested in linguistics actually work on this material. So the philologists tend to, the people who read texts and interpret texts don't often have a linguistics background, and the linguistics people don't often have the philological background that would enable them to actually read pre-modern texts that exist in inscriptions or in manuscripts. So much of the linguistic history of India is in fact a terra incognita for a lot of us. And this is especially true of the language family that Sanskrit and Hindi forms a part of. We have quite a lot of energy directed at Sanskrit, relatively speaking, of course. And of course, Hindi is one of the most spoken languages on planet Earth. And there's a certain amount of scholarship on Hindi grammar and how things got to be that way. But for the vast amount of time separating Sanskrit and Hindi, you have a large literary record of languages, including Prakrit, Apabhramsha, all sorts of other related middle Indic languages, Pali, Ardhamagadhi, and so on. And much of that evidence is not taken into account. So this is a long-winded way of saying that we need more people working in the field of Indian linguistics who are able to make use of this very rich archive of literary and documentary evidence.
So basically, do definitely learn Sanskrit, but don't stop there.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is definitely my advice to everyone in the field. I mean, Sanskrit, very interesting thing about Sanskrit is that for basically all of the texts that we ever read, they were composed by people who did not only speak Sanskrit. So we, you know, Plato spoke Greek, maybe something else. Probably not. Aristotle spoke Greek. Yeah, you know, Cicero spoke Latin and Greek, but not a single Sanskrit author who spoke Sanskrit or composed in Sanskrit did not speak another language. So Sanskrit always existed in a world where people were using other languages, often for literary purposes as well. So it's extremely important to understand that Sanskrit was only one part of this, what I have called the language order of India.
And that would then also be a call, not just to students, but also to anybody else from universities listening to this, that institutes of Indology, of South Asian studies and so on should offer those languages.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
So during your time as an undergrad, Was there any course that you enjoyed particularly? Any topic that you thought, oh wow, I had no idea that this existed and this is so fascinating? Or also, was there anything where you thought, I was expecting more of this and this is a great disappointment?
I have to say that I did not have the experience of a disappointing course ever. And I think that's because I just selected those things that I knew would interest me.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, many of my Sanskrit courses were, I'll give you a bit of background for the listeners. I am a white person from the suburbs of New York City. I had absolutely no exposure to Indian culture whatsoever before I, or in fact, to any culture whatsoever before I entered college. And so really, everything was new to me. And of course, Americans have this, even in high school, in my kind of relatively pragmatic, I would say, high school, where people just wanted us to get into college so that we could get jobs and be contributing members of society,
mm-hmm.
There was an awareness that there was some kind of European tradition that America was part of. So we kind of had some vague awareness that there were thinkers and writers that maybe if we were lucky, we would read one day. But when I began taking Sanskrit, I realized that there are similarly foundational important thinkers and writers in the Indian tradition, in the South Asian tradition, that I had never even heard of. And I was just really fascinated by this alternative world of intellectual and literary
pursuit and
creativity.
Endeavor.
Yes. So one of the things actually that comes to mind is when I did my degree in classics, I was working on Theocritus, who is a bucolic poet. He writes about pastoral subjects, so basically herders of sheep and goats, and his poems are about how these shepherds and goat herds will have contests where they sing poetry. And it's a very idealized landscape. It was quite influential. And there are all these questions about whether Theocritus's language, he uses a very distinct form of a Greek literary dialect, whether his language reflects his content in some way. So whether he chooses his language partly to reflect the speech of the characters who are often, unsophisticated, uneducated shepherds and goatherds. And as I was thinking about this, it was suggested to me by my Sanskrit teacher at the time, Sheldon Pollock, that I should look at Prakrit poetry, which some people have claimed has a similar dimension of linguistic realism, or at least this is a hypothesis that Prakrit is intended to represent the speech of certain characters who are, as in the case of Theocritus, not particularly educated. They're village people. They're not Sanskrit speakers. They're not elite educated people who can speak in Sanskrit. They speak in regular vernacular speech and Prakrit literature is supposed to be a representation of this. So I became interested in this as a comparative project first, thinking about how literature can represent the speech of let's say subaltern groups. And I started pursuing that. But then, of course, I came to the negative conclusion that, that's not what was actually going on, at least in the case of Prakrit. It invited me to think about these two traditions in parallel in a way that, I certainly would never have done had I not had these chance exposures to the traditions mm-hmm. over the course of my undergraduate education.
So where did you then take your work and your interests and your skills? What did you do with them for your PhD?
Well, I continued working on Prakrit because I found this language, which I was exposed to first as a kind of weird case of poets apparently writing poetry in a language that was like Sanskrit, but not exactly like Sanskrit. And why they used this weird language remained a question mark, at least for me. So I started getting into this scholarship on Prakrit and trying to figure out what people said about it. And the real question is, what was for me when I started my PhD, why? So there's a literary language that is used in pre-modern India from a very early point, which is Sanskrit. You also have another literary language called Prakrit, Prakritam, which was used as a literary language at approximately the same time. It's very similar to Sanskrit, except it has the grammar is a little bit different. The phonology is also quite distinctive. It's not exactly a simplified form of Sanskrit, but you can kind of think of it in that way. And these languages were used kind of side by side, but also in complementary ways. And so my question was, why do we have these two languages for literature? Is there some kind of division of labor? Is there some kind of historical explanation? Is Prakrit used for certain purposes and Sanskrit used for certain other purposes? And what are the poetics that are associated with these two languages? Is it a choice? Can authors choose to write in Sanskrit or Prakrit? So I tried to address a lot of these questions with my PhD research, which was basically into the subject of Prakrit as a literary language.
And so what were your answers to those questions? Can authors just choose?
Well, after a certain point, they could. But my main finding is that at a certain point, I mean, the history of Sanskrit and Prakrit are intimately linked. And I think that this is, if I succeed in making any change in the field, it's to think about Sanskrit and Prakrit as two sides of the same coin that develop in parallel. And obviously, everyone knows Sanskrit because of its religious significance and because classical literature in Sanskrit has been celebrated and elevated for a very long time. But there was a time in the history of South Asia when Sanskrit was not even called Sanskrit. It was just the language of the Vedic hymns, and then the language of works that were explaining and commenting and interpreting those hymns and discussing other technical aspects of those hymns. So this is a language that was preserved by a very small group of people, Brahmins, to transmit and reflect upon their religious literature. And that's all it was. And we have, of course, other literatures from a very early point. I mean, there's Buddhist literature and Jain literature, which I'll probably speak about shortly. But at a certain point, Sanskrit, this is a point that Sheldon Pollack has made very forcefully in his book, Language of the Gods and the World of Men. Sanskrit left the very constrained space of ritual reflection and became a language of literary expression and a language of systematic thought and a language of political power. And this happened sometime in the very mysterious span of time between the 3rd century BCE and the 3rd century CE, as one of my colleagues likes to say, with the time when all Sanskrit texts seem to have emerged. But clearly there was something going on in these couple of centuries where the nature of the Sanskrit language changed, the nature of writing and literary expression changed, and people were actively seeking out and experimenting with different literary languages. Sanskrit was one of them, but Prakrit was also one of them. And so at the very same time that people in North India, I'll put it this way. In the first and second centuries, to narrow down this time frame a little bit, the first and second centuries of the Common Era were very, very important. People tend to know very little about them, but during the second century, there was an empire, the Kushana Empire, that stretched from North India to Central Asia. And that empire is associated with some of the earliest works of Sanskrit literature that we have that we can attribute to a specific author. So Mathurcheta, the Buddhist author who wrote hymns, seems to have lived in the beginning or middle of the second century of the Common Era. And Ashwagosha, of course, the famous Buddhist poet, lived in the middle of the second century. And he wrote long poems about the life of the Buddha, about the conversion of Nanda, the Buddha's brother-in-law. And he also wrote plays. So we have, all of a sudden, we have the new genres that would characterize Sanskrit literature for many, many centuries. And this emerges in, I would say, the first or second century. The second century is also when we have 150 CE. We know it very precisely because it's dated. It's an inscription of Rudradaman, the Kshatrapa king of Gujarat, who writes, it's not exactly the first Sanskrit inscription, but it's one of the first Sanskrit inscriptions, and it has all of the features of that we would associate with classical Sanskrit. So clearly a major shift has taken place in this period, and Sanskrit has been cultivated very deliberately as a language of literary expression and political power. And at precisely the same time, a couple hundred miles to the south, Prakrit is being cultivated as a literary language by people in the Deccan, I would say in the Satavahana court. So this is another kingdom that is contemporary with the Kushanas and the Kshatrapas. So it's the second century, first and second century, the Satavahanas, they are ruling over the Deccan, that is Maharashtra, also parts of Telangana, parts of northern Karnataka. And they appear to give patronage to poets who write in this other literary language, which is Prakrit. So there's this foundational moment where these two languages are established as literary languages, and they come to form a kind of pair. And very often the people who are, I think that people who know Prakrit know Sanskrit and vice versa, and there's a lot of communication between these languages, but they have very different trajectories. Prakrit tends to be used for single verse lyric poetry, often on themes of love, whereas Sanskrit tends to be used for narrative poetry and hymns. But these genres and get combined in various interesting ways. So, so I would say that the main, this is a, sorry for the very long-winded explanation, but the my main answer is that it's really a historical accident, but a very interesting set of historical circumstances that leads Sanskrit and Prakrit to be elevated somewhat simultaneously as literary languages. And they actually remained as the primary literary languages of South Asia for many centuries. I should not emphasize their simultaneity too much because there's obviously the epic tradition, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And there's also a tradition of writing philosophical works or systematic works in Sanskrit that is quite a bit earlier than Prakrit literature. But I think that the general picture is as I've sketched it.
And for anybody whose interest has now been piqued and who came here wanting to hear more about Sanskrit and is hearing more about Prakrit, I recommend Andrew's wonderful book, Language of the Snakes, which I assume is the result of or based on your PhD research?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Yeah. So Language of the Snakes will be in the liner notes for this episode. If someone now is interested in Prakrit, and given that I've got you, basically, Mr. Prakrit, not sitting in front of me, but sitting on the other side of the computer screen, let me ask you, what would you recommend someone who is interested in Prakrit do? You know, are there any pedagogical works that you can recommend? Are there any texts that you can recommend for people to read?
Yes. I get this question kind of more often than I thought, which is good. I'm happy that people are interested. And it's not just Prakrit. I mean, I think that Prakrit stands in. I should also, maybe I'll just take 2 minutes to talk about a kind of terminological thing
that yes, please.
Has bothered me. So people often use the word Prakrit to mean any language that is related to Sanskrit, but is not quite Sanskrit. So it's been used to refer to everything from, let's say, Vedic forms that are not quite normal Sanskrit to basically Gujarati to, or, you know, basically anything that you can relate to Sanskrit, but seems not to be normal Sanskrit. And one of my interventions, or I tried to intervene in this way in the book, is to say that the tradition understands Prakrit to be a literary language. So, and it's not just that there was a conception that there were a bunch of different Prakrits in the plural. People often speak about this, that there are many different Prakrits, they're shouted saying, and these reflect forms of vernacular speech. That is wrong. Prakrit was a literary language that was certainly based on some form of a spoken language, as all literary languages are, but it was cultivated as a literary language with a very stable grammar for many centuries. And but because it was relatively more vernacular than Sanskrit, although that's not saying very much, people thought of Prakrit was notionally considered to be a vernacular. So when people thought about forms of speech that were close to the way that people actually spoke in everyday life, they sometimes used Prakrit as a label for those forms of speech. So the result of this is that in scholarship, especially modern scholarship, you'll see people talk about the Prakrits, and they'll often include things as late as Upper Brahmsha, which is another literary language that came to be used a little bit later than Prakrit, but was cultivated up until the 15th century. So really, people understand by this word a very wide range of languages, which means that when people ask me, oh, how do I learn Prakrit? Sometimes they are primarily interested in reading early Jain texts. Sometimes they're interested in reading Pali, in fact, which has sometimes been called a Prakrit. Sometimes they're interested in reading Aparibrahamsa texts from the 10th century, from the 11th century, 12th century. Sometimes they're even interested in learning the language of early North Indian vernacular texts, what people sometimes call old Gujarati, old Rajasthani, Maru Gujar. So it's a very wide range of languages. And I would say that if you want to get started, you should know what you want to read. So that's the main thing. You can obviously, sometimes people want to read Gandhari, which is the language of these new, these birch bark scrolls, which have been discovered relatively recently. And it's very exciting that there's now all this new literature in a language that was previously not very well known available. But you know, these are all actually rather different languages, and you can't conflate all of them because there are important differences between them. And if you're not thinking of those differences, then it's going to be very difficult for you to read these texts. So I would say step one, figure out what you're actually interested in reading and figure out what kind of language it is. So if you're interested in reading the literary works that are sometimes called classical literary works, like the Gaha Satasai, famous collection of Prakrit verses, or the Setubandha, a Prakrit story about Rama's killing of Ravana, or other works like that, you would be interested in what I call Prakrit, what sometimes scholars call Maharashtri Prakrit. If you're interested in reading the works of Kunda Kunda, other Digambara Jain philosophers, well, I'm really Kunda Kunda is the only one who writes in this language, you would be interested in a slightly different language that scholars call Jaina Shaurasena. This, again, is an invented term. Nobody ever used the term Jaina Shaurasena in pre-modern India, but people have characterized Kunda Kunda's language in this way. If you're interested in reading the commentaries on the Jain canonical texts, that is yet a different form of the language, and I would recommend different a different set of texts to begin mm-hmm. learning that. So that's the first step. The second step is then just starting to read. I think that Prakrit, in any of these forms, I mean, I think it's important to distinguish them, but once you make a decision, the grammar is not that difficult, especially, I mean, if you know Sanskrit. So again, I should say that you need to know Sanskrit for all of these. It's not like you can jump in. And so I think that if you have a good grounding in Sanskrit, you'll be able to read this material. And that's because many of these texts have commentaries. And these commentaries often do us the favor of translating the Prakrit into Sanskrit. So you can read the Prakrit text and then look at the Sanskrit translation and see, okay, so the first verse of the Gaha Satasai, Pasuvai no rosa runa parima sankanta gori moha andam. Pasuvai no, you look at it and you say, Pasuvai no, I don't know what Pasuvai no is. Then you look at the Sanskrit commentary and it will say, Pashupatehe, genitive singular of Pashupati. You say, oh, okay, I can kind of see that. And you can kind of work out how the Sanskrit form has been transformed into Prakrit. And if you do that with the help of a skeleton grammar, I've compiled one. I know that many other Prakrit teachers have compiled one. It's basically just one or two pages of the basic transformations that you need to know and the case endings and the verbal endings. You will be well on your way. So to make this clear, I am suggesting a course of self-study. At the moment, there are Prakrit courses that you can take. The American Institute of Indian Studies offers a Prakrit course in Pune over the summer. But I think if you have strong Sanskrit, Prakrit is very accessible and very fulfilling. You'll find yourself, I'm sure you'll be pleased after a while of really puzzling things out. You'll start to find it much easier, and then you'll have access to a totally new realm of literature.
And also, I mean, from a Sanskritist's point of view, yet another reason why Sanskrit is always a useful thing to know.
Yes, of course, yeah.
So where did you take your work, or where did your work take you after your PhD research?
So now that I had kind of opened the door to Prakrit literature, at least for myself, I began to appreciate just how much, Prakrit literature is, everyone who studies Sanskrit knows that there is this other language called Prakrit, especially if we read plays, we see that some of the characters speak in a language that's not Sanskrit. And so we very often just read the Sanskrit translation that's, you know, either given in the footnotes or maybe is actually put in the text itself. So we know that this language is actually used, but Sanskrit scholars don't pay much attention to it. I will not say anything bad about one of the truly great scholars in our field, Madhav Deshpande. His book, Sanskrit and Prakrit, Sociolinguistic Issues, was really interesting to me. I mean, the subject is absolutely interesting. I think that he's exactly right in many of his analyses there. But it's a book that has Prakrit in the title and basically does not engage with Prakrit literature at all, because Prakrit is simply the other of Sanskrit for most of that book. So it's has always been the understudied sister or cousin of Sanskrit in our field. And I have, when you start looking at actual Prakrit texts, you realize how much work there is to be done. So not just in terms of, so take the most famous Prakrit text, the Gaha Sapta Sahi, or Gathas Saptashati, the 700 gathas, 700 single verse poems in Prakrit, compiled by Hala. This is a work that has recently been translated by Peter Kurosh and Herman Tikan. I think a lot of people read it, just precisely how influential this work was in Indian literary history is—it's hard to overstate. It was very influential. You can see echoes of it in Kalidasa. You can see reimaginings of its verses in the Amarushataka. It was an enormously influential text, and precisely what its poetics are. How the work as a whole operates. These are things that I think we still need a lot of work on. And in fact, there's a lot of basic philological work to do on this text as well. Many of the commentaries have not been edited yet. We don't have a critical, we have Albrecht Weber's critical edition from 1881, but nothing since then. And there's been a lot of discoveries since then. So there's also many Prakrit texts that have just not been read at all. I mean, one that I tried looking at in my thesis was one called the Rasika Prakashana, or Raya Payasana of Vairochana. This is it's another anthology of verses by a Buddhist author, Vairochana. It has never been published, so I had the ambition of working on an edition and translation of it, but it's quite difficult when you don't have a commentary. There's no work, no scholarly work on the text whatsoever, and every single verse is you're seeing it for the first time. So I'm hoping that at some point I'll have read enough Prakrit in my life. I'll put in my, what is it, the Gladwell's like 10,000 hours or something like that. And it'll just click and I'll be able to read it like a newspaper, but I'm not at that point yet. But yeah, many, many, many other texts. I mean, yes. And so I've been occupied with some Prakrit works of poetics, works that commentaries on the Saptasai. I've been increasingly interested in a form of literature that I have to say that I did not spend a lot of time looking at when I was working on my PhD thesis. You know, we can't do everything, but it's actually probably one of the most important genres of texts in Prakrit for various reasons, for historical reasons as well. And these are the commentaries on the Jain, Shvetambara Jain canonical texts. They're called Niryuktis. They are written in Prakrit verse. They're often ascribed to a Jain monk named Bhadrabahu. And they comment upon the canonical texts of the Jain tradition. So these are texts, sometimes they're narrative texts, sometimes they're texts of monastic discipline. But these Niryuktis are amazingly interesting because they just contain so much, a wealth of cultural information that is impossible to get from any other source. But because they're so difficult and in fact, they are in a very rough and difficult and strange kind of Prakrit. They've been hard to utilize and hard to read. So this is also another genre of text that I've been looking more into recently. So one direction of my work since the PhD has been exploring the very, very large field of Prakrit literature and trying to see what the most urgent tasks in that field are.
I now have for you a piece of very, very good news, which is that you have won the absolutely fabulous, but unfortunately also absolutely fictional, Sanskrit Studies Podcast Research Grant, which allows you to work on any research project that you might be interested in on your own or with others for as long as you need to. First of all, congratulations. Second of all, what are you going to use this wonderful grant for?
Well, it's not totally fictional because I, you know, to be honest, I have this research money at the University of Chicago and I've been really racking my brain about it. How to spend it,
what a very nice problem to have.
Yes. Maybe I at this point I can talk about another research direction that I've also been moving into recently, which is Kannada literature. Mm-hmm. And For this, I think, let me say that I'm honored to accept this totally fictional award, and I will use it for a project that I've actually been working on in a preliminary way for the past couple of months, which is, so Kannada is another literary language of India. It is a South Indian language spoken in the state of Karnataka. It has the longest history of any Indian vernacular language apart from Tamil. So we have inscriptions that go back maybe to the 5th century of the Common Era, and we have literary texts that go back that are preserved in manuscripts. The texts themselves go back to the 9th century. So it's a very long literary tradition. It's a vernacular literary tradition, and the fashioning of a literary vernacular on the model of Sanskrit, but also self-consciously distinct from Sanskrit, is a part of the Kannada literary project from the beginning. This is also something that Sheldon Pollack has talked about in Language of the Gods and the World of Men. I was interested in this language. I started learning it with my colleague, Sarah Pierce Taylor, some years ago. And I have been on the one hand, the number of questions that I have about this literature is just enormous. I mean, there's a large corpus of early literature, let's say from the 9th to the 12th centuries. And this is literature of an exceptionally high quality. And it's literature that is composed at the same time that people were producing what in Kannada, as well in Sanskrit, people call Lakshana Granthas. So these are works that talk about the norms of literary composition. These can be grammatical norms, they can be poetic norms, metrical norms. Especially if you don't read modern Kannada, this is just a complete absence in the literary history of India. So one of the earliest vernacular traditions produces this wealth of literature that's extremely sophisticated and self-conscious about its vernacularity, and nobody knows anything about it. Of course, Kannada scholars know a thing or two about it, but I would say almost every single thing written about Kannada literature is written in Kannada, which of course makes sense. But this basically means that if you want to work on this literary tradition, you need to learn the modern language. Again, that makes sense, and I have been working on my modern Kannada, but the project that I would use this money for is stage one is making accessible the main conclusions, the really important works of research that have been done by scholars in Karnataka. First of all, making that available to a wider scholarly public, people who are interested in Indian literary history. So that means translating works of scholarship in Indian vernacular languages, in this case, Kannada. So there are many great scholars who have written written about this literature in Kannada. M. Chidanantamurthy comes to mind, Kalaburgi, Mulya Temappaya, T.V. Venkatachala Shastri. I think it's important for us to really start from this strong base of really excellent philological work in Kannada. But then there's a whole set of empirical questions that we can ask and we should ask. And empirical research has this kind of well, it's divisive, I would say. I mean, a lot of people think that, you know, simply asking questions that have discrete answers is not really research. but
bodies would disagree. They always want you to say, I'm going to ask these questions and I'm likely going to find those answers, and only then will they give you money. Apologies. This is just me being cynical. Yeah.
A lot of research in the United States is not funded by research bodies, is undertaken by scholars with permanent positions at universities who might have a different approach to these questions. But I would say that the reason why asking very basic questions and getting very basic answers is kind of looked down upon, at least that's my feeling, is that many of those basic questions have already been answered in many, many fields, including Sanskrit. I mean, we know what, we kind of have some sense of how Sanskrit literature works in, at least in terms of its forms, its genres, its metrical practices. We can do some kind of basic, we have a sense of the style of different authors, say Kalidasa or Pavabhuti and so on. But when it comes to Kannada literature, again, this is a complete unknown. And so I have been working on the earliest Kannada text to survive, the Kaviraj Margam, with a colleague here at the University of Chicago, Sarah Pierce Taylor. This is the Kaviraj Margam, The Way of the Poet King, gives all sorts of advice for how to write in Kannada. And one of the questions that we have had is, are these rules, is this advice actually followed? So one of the things that we've been trying to figure out is, does the Kaviraja Margam actually articulate norms that people follow in subsequent literature? Or is it just this kind of weird one-off text that nobody really pays attention to? And one way to look at it would be to see if the subsequent Kannada literature of the 10th century, let's say, follows its recommendations regarding metrical practice, regarding alliteration, which is a structural feature in Kannada poetry, regarding the choice of words and the combination of Kannada and Sanskrit words. And these are all things that, as far as I know, no empirical research has been done on. So figuring out what the norms of Kannada literary composition are in the earliest period, what forms are available, how the meters work, in fact, how basic structural features like alliteration, second syllable alliteration work. These are all things that we need a corpus of texts to answer. And so what I would do is digitize all Kannada literature and then get a bunch of smart people to figure out ways of answering some of these questions and posing and figuring out new questions to ask of this corpus of texts. And of course, this is something I think we can do with any archive. We can do it with Aparbrahmsha, we can do it with Prakrit, we can do it with Sanskrit. But I think I personally am most excited about Kannada, because I think that those are really where the main questions that I have are.
Well, I see that you're putting the money of the research grant to very, very good use, and I'm looking forward to seeing or reading the results. We've been talking about work with South Asian languages, with Sanskrit, with Prakrit, from an academic, from a scholarly point of view. Are there any works that have inspired you sort of in a more layman's way? So are there any books about South Asia, about anything to do with the many cultures of South Asia, any movies, any TV programs, anything that you've particularly enjoyed and that you might recommend to people who are interested in the field?
Yes. My colleague Anand Venkatkrishnan and I, you have had Anand on the podcast recently. We just finished an article that had a long gestation period, but it was an article about a commentary on Bhavabhuti's play, the Rama, Uttara Rama Charita, the Rama's last act, as Sheldon Pollack has translated it. This is probably my favorite Sanskrit play, and you know, I don't want to get into discussions of literary merit, especially across traditions, but this is, I think, one of the best plays in any language that I've ever read. Bhavabhuti is just an amazingly deep and expressive author. And if you haven't read the Rama's Last Act, just do it now. Like after listening to this, just go out and buy the book in Sheldon Pollack's translation and read it. Because I think it's the emotional richness of the play and also the kind of poetic self-awareness it's hard to think of anything in the Sanskrit canon that parallels it. So that's something that I appreciate. And I've been finding, I mean, I don't want to, like, you asked me a question about, like, whether the things that inspire me, and I don't want to answer the question by saying, by listing all the things that don't inspire me, but I have to say that the text that people often cite as the classical, major, amazing works of Sanskrit literature, like Kalidasa, for instance, are not the texts that I would go to. There are, Indian literature is a really vast field, and I think it's been poorly served by people selecting a couple of very hyper-canonical authors and saying, this is the epitome of South Asian literature. I think that, everyone should be empowered to make their own decisions about what is really interesting, what is really compelling about South Asian literature. There's Kannada literature provides a lot of material here, especially if you're interested in, you know, social justice. I mean, this is something that I will leave it to colleagues who, I don't work on this period, but the literature of Kannada literature of the 12th century and onwards, associated with Basava, that was these so vachanas, they're so called, the statements of Basava and his followers, that they were translated by A.K. Ramanujan in this book, Speaking of Shiva. That's another really, I mean, it's been an inspirational corpus of literature for a lot of people. I realized recently that the poet Ted Hughes was inspired to write vachanas of his own after reading Ramanujan's book. And so this is another type of literature that I find very inspiring. The other thing, when I teach, a introductory South Asian literature class, one of the things that I like very much, I mean, I only teach the things that I like in that course, which is, so there's basically, I like everything that we read in that class. Dundan's Dashakumara Charita is amazing. Again, that's another work that if you haven't read it, you should just go out and buy Isabel Onyanz's translation of it. But also the early Tamil poetry is something that I just find very moving, very, very poetic. The images are often very unique, and the poetic techniques are very fresh, direct, suggestive. And so the poems, they're often called Sangam poems on the basis of this idea that the poems were compiled in a academy of Tamil poets or a Sangha, as it would be called in Sanskrit, of course. But these are poems that are collected in anthologies like the Kuruntukai. Read the Kuruntukai. That's another thing that I would suggest.
Thank you very much. There is a lot. So everybody who's, you know, listening to this podcast will have their next couple of days or weeks basically cut out for them. Thank you very much. One final question that I would like to ask, and you've partly, I think, already answered it, but in this field of academic study of in our case, South Asia and everything that has to do with South Asia, but also in academia more generally, what do you think works well at the moment? And what do you think could or should be changed?
Yeah, I mean, academia, it's like, you know, the United States in the sense that like the ideals, the founding ideals are noble and lofty, but the reality is often falls very far short of those ideals. And I think that the idea that that all of us are engaged on more or less equal terms in a collaborative project of producing knowledge is, that's something that I find amazing. And I am really consider it a privilege to be part of that collective project. I like working with people, and I think collaborating with other scholars and being able to share expertise, complementary forms of expertise in the service of finding out new things about India's literary or philosophical traditions. This is something that we should be doing more of. There's not a lot of encouragement to do that from a kind of institutional perspective, but I think that you can take the initiative and try to find colleagues who you want to work with. Well, that said, I think that there's when you do work with people, you realize that every single other person in the field has a very different story, very different interests, very different set of skills. And the main thing that I think holds us back as a field, and I think this is true of Indology in particular, but also South Asian studies in general, is that it's too small. There are not enough of us. And we don't have the critical mass in our institutions to often have a voice that people will listen to. So scholarship on South Asia is often very marginal to scholarship in the rest of the university and the rest of academia. And this is a kind of, there's a negative feedback loop that happens there, where the more marginal scholarship is, the less that South Asianists feel like they need to engage with work outside of their field, which means that there's been it's hard to generalize about the field because it is so small, but I think that there's a tendency for you know, philological work to just be exclusively philological and not speak to interpretive questions. There's an avoidance of theoretical interventions coming from wherever they come from. And this is, I mean, it's a two-way street, obviously. So obviously our colleagues in philosophy, comparative literature, they more often than not do not have any awareness or interest in work on South Asia. And so I think that there, this is a big problem, but one way to address it, I think, is just to have more of us and to have a kind of critical mass where we are having our own interesting conversations that are actually conversations. I mean, if this field is so small, you know, one person writes one book and then another person writes a book that kind of engages with it 15 years later. And so the conversations are very punctuated, and the number of people participating in these conversations and the number of voices and perspectives is very limited. I'm envious of other fields where the conversations are much more lively and there are more perspectives. Obviously in our field, diversity has been a big issue. It continues to be a big issue. And that's something that I think we could make big steps to correcting if we just increase the size of the field. But obviously this depends on money and other things that are somewhat outside of our control. The smallness of it's something that's bothered me for a while, because I often think, like, when we have to, when publishers ask us to basically, you know, do the work that publishers should do for them, I wonder whether that they would ask the same things of people in other fields. But many other things that are symptoms of being a very small field. You're talking to the same people all the time, which is great if especially if you like talking to those people. But I think we would benefit a lot from more voices in the conversation.
Well, I mean, you're very right that there are certain things that people like you and I cannot influence, such as, you know, money. But I have found everything that you've said in the past hour very, very interesting, and I'm sure that I'm not the only one. And so I hope that this podcast will play a very, very small part towards maybe getting more people interested in the field and active in the field. Maybe that will affect exactly the change that basically you've been describing, and the change that you're quite right is necessary. So thank you very much, Andrew Ollert, for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Andrew.